If you've been missing your tales of, I don't know, Game of Thrones, that sort of thing, your medieval adventure, your fantasy adventure, well, stay tuned, because my next guest has got more family intrigue and bloodletting than the House Targaryen or whatever, or Stark put together. In The Restless King, Nick Barrett presents the tumultuous struggle for supremacy between the first Plantagenet king, Henry II, and his four sons, a drama that tore apart the most powerful family in Western Europe and shape the future of two nations. There are still repercussions today. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, author of The Restless Kings, Nick Barrett. Nick, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Plantagenets. Now, this is a story that, even though it happened 800 years ago, still has a resonance with us today. Explain, if you will, where we are in history. Henry II, if my decaying grey matter serves me correctly, this is the person who had Becket murdered by mistake?
That's correct, yes. We're talking about the middle of the 12th century, so it seems far enough ago to be completely irrelevant to today. But what was happening was, in many ways, the emergence of an enmity between France and England that would last for the best part of 700 years, up to the Entente Cordiale of 1906. And it came about through a family dispute, firstly between the Plantagenets, who controlled large parts of France, Anjou, Maine, Aquitaine through marriage, Normandy and Brittany, and also held the crown of England, with the kings of France, the Capetians, led by Louis VII, and then, when he died, his son, Philip Augustus, who was a remarkable man. And these clash of titans played out over the best part of 60 years, resulting in the loss of all of those continental possessions by the English family, which meant that by the time Henry died and his first son Richard had also left the scene, King John was now looking after these possessions. And he was a terrible man. He was psychotic. He was violent. He murdered his nephew with his bare hands. He bedded the wives of his nobles. All sorts of terrible things. And he lost a lot. And it all happened at a battle that's probably not recognized in European history as up there amongst the greats. But the Battle of Bouvines set the tone for the next 700 years in 1214. So it's a really dramatic story. Not just this battle between the two main families, but Henry II and his sons tearing themselves to pieces as well. I mean, this really is Game of Thrones, but real. So it's a gripping story. But I still think it has got that resonance today, particularly when we're looking at this turmoil around Brexit and what it means to be British or European or both. And many of the seeds of discord you can find being sown in this period. So it's really relevant.
Now, just tell us a little bit about what the situation is, because we kind of have this romantic view, perhaps, of the English nobles being loyal to their king and the French nobles being loyal to theirs. But in reality, I mean, it was very much Plantagenet, the houses, the strong houses of England were against each other, each other's throats, and the sons had been encouraged to rebel. And even Henry's own wife sided with her children.
Yeah, that's right. I think the first thing is that there wasn't really a sense of I'm English or I'm French. They were all part of an intermingled aristocracy that spread across the Channel, spread across France, and also into other parts of Europe as well. So the schism that took place in 1204 when King John lost these lands really started that split between families. And in many ways, what the aristocracy saw was Henry's own family pulling itself apart as well. Now, Henry was a formidable man. He had the world at his feet by the time he was 19. Him, with the support of his mother and father, had captured England from his family rivals, so he'd got England sorted out. He'd inherited Normandy and Anjou, and he had this spectacular marriage to Eleanor of Aquitaine, a famed beauty of her age, an intellectual as well, who'd been cast aside by her husband, the King of France. Henry saw an opportunity, and the two of them wed very quickly. And as a result, he gained control of large parts of the south of France. So within a few years, he had gained this enormous territory, a beautiful wife who bore him 8 children, 4 strapping sons. And you'd think that that would be a wonderful scenario, but actually that's where the problem started. All of his sons wanted lands of their own. They inherited their father's fiery temperament. And so in many ways, that's where the intrigue started. The wily King of France played father against son, and most of the time the sons fought against their father. Henry had to deal with rebellions throughout his realm, and it really wore him down. There are some really heartbreaking scenes at the end where this poor king, who's fought to maintain unity, to maintain peace, is brought to his knees literally by his sons raging against him and supporting the King of France.
It was called the Great Revolt. So what sort of, apart from the French king sort of whispering Iago like in their ears that they could take that they could have what was duly theirs and rightfully theirs. I mean, what sort of support did the young royals, the princes, have, and how did the Great Revolt unfold?
Well, there were various stages. There were lots of disaffected Norman aristocrats who were really quite fed up by the way Henry marched in. Don't forget, there'd been a long hatred between the Angevins and the Normans, and here was an Angevin coming to lord it over the Normans. So there was a lot of disaffected Norman nobles who were just really ready to kick off the yoke of Angevin power. So there was, in many ways, a powder keg that Henry was sitting on. In England, when he first inherited the throne, he had to end 19 years of civil war, faction fighting between families. And to do that, he'd had to make some really tough decisions. He'd cast aside some of his mother's supporters who'd been hoping he would come in and support their rights. That wasn't going to happen. He also had to deal with many of the, decades-old grievances that he had to face from the opposition sides. And he did this by marginalizing many of the traditional aristocrats. So when Louis was whispering to his sons on the continent, they saw the opportunity to, again, throw off the yoke of Henry's power in England and try and stage their own rebellion. Now, the thing about this was that it was all great talking about it, but in isolation, everyone got a bit scared, and Henry couldn't be in everywhere at once. He rattled around. This is where the title comes from, like a restless king. Firefighting in every single scene of war. He would pop up like some sort of demon out of a trapdoor in the famous phrase of a chronicler of the time, and would quell rebellion. So he was really quite a remarkable man. But it did seem like he was firefighting on every front. He also had extraordinary luck. Many of his supporters did manage to hold the line before he could come. There was one notable example where his supporters in the north managed to capture the King of Scotland, who was causing problems on the border, and dragged him in chains down to stand before Henry, who then fell upon mercy and managed to give him a bit of support. So there's all sorts of moments where Henry was both lucky but also really shrewd. He stayed his hand and waited to see where the most trouble would be, rushed there, dealt with it, and then gave this impression that he could be it everywhere at once.
I mean, one of the things that you have to have to bear in mind as well is logistics, because it's not as if they're rushing up the M6 to deal with this. I mean, it's a wild country, and also the scale of the revolt, because we're talking about, as you said, the King of Scotland is involved, which is obviously Hadrian's Wall, and then we've got the battles going on in Brittany across the La Manche, the English Channel. So it's a huge, as you say, it's a huge firefighting operation.
Well, it was also a European revolt in many ways, because this wasn't just about Henry and Louis. There were all sorts of imperial politics as well. And this, I think, is where it's been so interesting researching the book, looking at the wider European picture. In Britain, we always focus on the Anglo-centric view of the world, but actually this was a European battle first and foremost. And England, and these issues with Scotland and Ireland as well, where Henry had gone in and conquered large parts, were many much the sidelines. He wasn't so much interested in that. He wanted to look after his father's lands in Anjou, the lands that his mother had brought him in Normandy. That was where he saw the main issue. And so in doing that, he spent a lot of time in Brittany, but also to the south as well. He was really concerned with Aquitanian politics, which leads you onto the borders with Spain, which have obviously its own kingdoms and a lot of Moorish presence. And all of this is a remnant of the older Roman world, which still comes into play. So we think this is a long way distant from our current situation with Brexit, but equally, it is really relevant looking at what happened at the fall and breakup of the Roman Empire. So he was fighting with communication routes that would have been familiar to people several hundred years before his time as well. So we don't have the internet, we don't have the phone, we don't have the telegram, we don't have good roads, we obviously know that. But he did have a very sophisticated communications network, relying on boats crossing the channel on a regular basis, with key castles that would then act as regional bases, with knights who would ride out to find the supporters. So yes, it was difficult, but you cannot underestimate the sophisticated administrative machinery that he put in place. That was how he managed to manage this empire, as well as predecessors had also managed to control large parts of Europe.
And if you look at, one of the things that tickled me, giving a quick sort of cursory glance over the information over the weekend, is the great houses of England, or the great sort of, you know, the barons or the earls, who seem to crop up, whenever there's a revolt in medieval England, they're the same. I mean, obviously the name, the people change, but it's the same bleeding houses, the Earl of Norfolk and the Earl of Leicester.
The bigots. Bigots were always in it. If there was a fight, they'd be the first ones to stir up trouble. They were very rarely successful, mind you, and they'd lie low, but they would always crop up and cause trouble. And I think, again, that's a really interesting situation where many of the cross-channel families had to make those decisions. And after 1204, John inherited even more problems, because many of the people that he thought were friends and allies resented the fact they'd lost all of their lands on the continent. So then you find some more names coming in. But the Earls of Leicester, the Montfort family, they are a perennial thorn in the side of the crown, not just for this period, but for many years afterwards. Simon de Montfort in 1264 defeated Henry III at the Battle of Lewes and took over the government for the best part of a year. So they are always there, struggling and fighting and pushing. And again, we think this harmonious picture of king managing the aristocrats, managing their knights, who then manage the tenant farmers. It isn't like that at all. There's factions, there's regional issues, there's different patterns of authority. When you really get under the skin, it's a wild west frontier land in many places where the king simply could not go because he couldn't exert any control. The people were just against him, implacably opposed to what he was trying to do.
I've just got this vision of Boris Johnson retreating to Norfolk and planning his next move.
You do get that sense that no matter what you say, the Brexiteers will pop up. And it was very much like this at the time. Let's not forget that within 60 years, the King of England went from being someone who was one of the most powerful figures on the European stage to a marginalised figure trapped in their own country, looking wistfully across the Channel at all the stuff they'd lost, with the result that they were pinned, they were nailed to account in the fields of Runnymede in 1215. Let's make no bones about it. Runnymede and Magna Carta is seen as this statue of liberty in many ways, in that it is a statute, and it was intended to regulate the relationship between the crown and the leading nobles. But actually, it was more about pinning the crown to good government, to focusing attention on English politics and English government, rather than going overseas and leaving it to the hands of bureaucrats. And in many ways, you get that sense of it's a very similar story then as now. No matter how much you try and appease these people, they'll always pop up with a new set of demands. Nothing will ever satisfy them. So yeah, Boris Johnson, the big odds, perhaps you should beware. Throughout history, they've always had their heads cut off.
The thing is, though, I mean, after the revolt had finished and Henry had, quote-unquote, claimed a victory, perhaps a Pyrrhic victory, though, because, you know, he'd lost, some of his sons were killed in the revolt, and, you know, he'd lost huge swathes of power and influence.
Well, it was one of those weird things where, as soon as the revolt was finished, he took stock and he pardoned his family, although he never regained the trust of his wife. He cast her to one side. This is when he openly started living with Rosamond, who was the daughter of one of his nobles. There's a lot of that in the Plantagenet period. And she was effectively locked up for the rest of the reign. But he did at least try to listen to his son's demands and gave them more power. But just like the Brexiteers, that would not satisfy them. And it was mainly his young King Henry, who he had crowned to give him a little bit more power, who led this revolt. He was a wastrel. He wanted to go out onto the European tournament circuit. He wanted power, but he didn't want to knuckle down to the business of government. And he stirred up so much trouble in the south. He allied mostly with his next oldest brother, Geoffrey, against the third son, Richard. And that was the problem. No matter what Henry II, Henry the Elder, tried to do, his sons would squabble with each other and then turn to him to resolve it, often with further demands for more land. So he had a really tricky situation, and his sons kept dying off, usually during the course of a revolt against him. The young king died when he was stirring up trouble in Aquitaine. He caught dysentery, we think, and he tried to get his father to see him on his deathbed, but his father didn't trust him. He sent him a ring as a token of his affection, and that was it. And by the time the old king realised that his son Ginny, when he was dying, it was too late. He never had a chance to give him his forgiveness, so he regretted that, I think. Geoffrey was even worse. A lot of the chroniclers pour opprobrium upon him. He was a horrible individual. He was suave and charming, but you couldn't trust him. A real snake in the grass. He too died in tragic circumstances. He was trampled to death at a tournament hosted by Philip Augustus, the King of France, as they were plotting to start yet another rebellion against Henry II. So you kind of get the feeling that they got their just desserts in the end.
And the son who did succeed, Richard I, Coeur de Lion.
Yeah, incredible character. He was far more like his mother than his father in the sense that he was brought up in Aquitaine and Poitou. He loved the South. He loved challenging the local lords. A lot of the families in the South were even more rebellious and unwilling to concede power to the king than in England. And they were permanently in a state of hatred, the Lusignan family in particular. So Richard spent most of his daily life learning the art of warfare by fighting the local barons, how to break castle sieges, for example. And he led the final rebellion against his father, successfully, as it turned out. And he was leading the revolt when Henry finally died on his deathbed, basically saying, "My sons have turned against me." But Richard's is one of those European figures that I think transcend the ages. He famously led the crusade into the Middle East nominally, jointly with Philip Augustus, but they fell out quite quickly when Philip realised that Richard was not going to marry Philip's sister. In fact, he'd cast her aside and already made plans to marry someone else. So that didn't go down at all well. And there were all sorts of slights on the campaign trail. Richard won the respect of many of the French knights, again, that drove a wedge between Philip and Richard. Philip left very early after the fall of Acre, which they were besieging. And Richard, therefore, fulfills this role as a champion of the West, a champion of Christendom. Yet in doing so, he made so many enemies across the wider European political scene that ultimately he was captured, imprisoned, and then had to be ransomed back, leading to the next round of bloodletting on the continent. So it's a really interesting insight into the tensions between Europe and the Middle East then and now, but equally going back, as I said earlier, to what the situation was at the fall of the Roman Empire when all of this land was connected. So I think there's a pattern beginning to emerge, not just now, but this ceaseless return to how the Roman Empire had spread across North Africa, the Middle East, and large parts of Europe. And, of course, it was federal then, and we're looking at a federal situation now. This is an important part of that story.
When you came to actually to sort of plot out this book, Nick, you must have looked and gone and shaken your head and said, this is the whole thing about the history repeating itself and drawing strong parallels, and even more so now.
Yeah, I think it is. I wish more people could look at that bigger view of things. So we focus on European citizenship and a single currency and a common legal framework and a single market. That all came to pass in 212 AD. The Emperor Caracalla created an edict where all citizens of his realm would have the same rights. And really, it's been a search to regain those rights ever since. So from that nadir of federal Europe, we are still, I think, stumbling towards that vision. Some key people that when I was writing the book, I never thought I would encounter, such as Caracalla. I'd never heard of him. And I don't think many people would have done. But also Charlemagne, who was, I think, the main character who tried to reunite many of these disassembled lands after the migration of peoples from the Germanic tribes of the north, destroying Rome, and then gradually starting to coalesce into states that we'd find familiar today. Charlemagne brought all of this together, and it was really his decision after becoming Holy Roman Emperor to split it up again that I think presages what we see in the Restless Kings. For me, there are various moments in European history where the continent both comes together and then falls apart again.
Whenever you mention the word Charlemagne, whenever you mention the word Charlemagne, the name Charlemagne, I can hear Eurosceptics across the broadcast area rankling even now, because that name, even though it's hundreds of years later, can still stir up emotions.
I find that remarkable, but I think also we need to look at some of the lessons of what he tried to achieve. And there was a uniformity to the way he structured his administrative lands. It was a really interesting model. I'm not saying that it wasn't without bloodshed, and most of it was forcibly imposed upon those areas. And let's also not forget that it broke up quite quickly. But it broke up into the main power blocks that we can still discern throughout the course of European history. What would eventually become France, the land of the West Franks, what would become Germania, Germany, and of course the Holy Roman Empire, which takes in other parts of Austria-Hungary and parts of Italy. Those were the main power blocks. And I think looking at England, Britain's role has to be within that context. And some of the great wars and the great battles are mainly continental European affairs, of which Britain plays a marginal part. I know a lot of people don't want to hear that, but if you want to understand the challenges today, you have to look at these key moments, the reign of Henry II, the reign of Charlemagne, and the breakup of the Roman Empire. That is the context of the current debate. That is why so many people are so passionate about a peaceful federal state, because of the alternatives, because of the constant warfare and these clash of power blocks that have defined the European story over so many centuries.
The book is called The Restless Kings. It's out next week, I believe, by Faber and Faber. Nick, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, do you do the social media thing? Is there a website?
I do. I've got a Twitter handle. It's at FamilyHistorySH. There weren't enough characters for it to end up as Family History Show.
Right.
That's at Family History SH. And that's where I discuss things such as medieval history and state finance with modern genealogy, public history, all sorts of stuff. So I just love chatting about history.
Just quickly, because it's such a complex and interesting period of history, and there's so many characters in this. Is there a character that you discovered that we really should be looking at again and thinking, that person, he or she, kind of had it figured out at that point, or were they all pretty much of a matchness of madness?
I am drawn to King John. Now, that's a controversial choice because he is, in many people's view, the worst king of England. And as a person, he is thoroughly dislikable. There isn't a single redeeming feature. However, it is that tortured nature that I think I find so interesting, because regardless of whether you like him or loathe him as a person, he was a highly effective administrator. And what he did in the 10, 11 years in which he was bottled up in England, a bit like a wasp in a bottle, he used to argue, he was zipping around and doing things. He whipped into shape a very troublesome realm, and he governed in the way that no one had governed before, and no one would govern for many years afterwards. He was relentless, he was restless, he had a single goal. He also could be very brave. Some of his military campaigns in the continent were incredible. And I also think he was very unlucky and also disadvantaged. He was the youngest son. Even his father joked and called him Lackland. He wasn't given any proper governance, so you just wonder how much his cause and effects. He was untrustworthy because he wasn't trusted, but he was never trusted with governance to show he could be a capable individual. So for me, he's an incredible person, and one that I think deserves a little bit more sympathy in terms of what he actually achieved, as well as possibly the criticism that he rightfully receives too.
Why are my alarm bells going off saying Rees-Mogg at the moment? But there you go. The book is called The Restless Kings. It's out next week. Nick Barrett, it's been a pleasure to speak to you today.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely talking to you.